Clark are able to get rid of one. Wriggling loose. Gives it on to the old campaigner, Jones. Gets the first of the last.
Oh, here's the lifeblood, isn't he? He's the connection with the last final they played.
Has been for a long, long time. We speak of Nathan Jones, of course, who this weekend becomes just the second Melbourne player to play 300 games. What an occasion to play a milestone game, Wisp.
Massive game.
Anzac Day Eve against the title holders. And he will do it justice, as he has done for every game that he's pulled on the Melbourne jumper. And we congratulate him and celebrate him. And he joins us this morning. Nath, well done.
Morning, fellas. Thanks, guys.
It feels like I saw you only an hour ago. So it's nice to talk. You got a busy week?
Not too bad, mate. I sort of had a chat to our media guy. I said, can we just try and cram it in at the start so I can relax and prepare for the game? We're coming off a six-day break, so trying to get it all done in the first sort of 24, 48 hours and then be in the training and just preparing for the game as normal.
Hey, Nathan, congratulations on playing the 300 games at the weekend. It's a mighty effort. You've been one of the great warriors of the game. Did Gary actually ask you a great question last night or anything that you hadn't been asked before?
No, he actually said some very kind words at the end of the show, which they very much touched the heartstrings. So I appreciated the kind words and, it's... I'm looking onwards and upwards. I'm excited for the weekend. I sort of have to pinch myself that I'm lucky enough to be playing in this game. And, obviously the significance of the occasion for myself personally, it's my favourite game on the footy calendar. And, we're excited to get out there and have another crack.
No, then I think everybody in the game, even those that don't barrack for Melbourne, they admire the way that you go about your football and what you've been able to achieve in the time that you've been playing football. What does the game mean to you?
I'm not going to lie, it hasn't been an easy road. It's not something, my career probably wasn't mapped out like I would have planned when I got drafted, and I definitely haven't taken it for granted, that's for sure. It's in my seventh and eighth game in my first year, I played finals and I was thinking, how good's this? And then it's, I think 12, 13 years later, I get another chance. So it's been pretty tough during those years. Some of the more difficult times I've faced as far as the success of the team and where we were at. But I think what has sort of defined my career is what I sort of see as success with the sort of road that was mapped out for me was the ability to just keep picking myself back up and taking small steps forward and I guess never really giving up. And there's been always this like one sort of little light in my own mind of imagining what it could potentially look like coming from where we were getting back to the top if we could. And being a part of that was the one thing that sort of drove me through that period.
And Nathan, you've spoken in the last 24 hours about the fact that you believe that this side now is more mature than other sides, particularly teams of, like the team of a couple of years ago. What is it about this team that you think is more prepared to take on to qualify for the finals, but to take on the better, more credentialed sides in the competition at the pointy end of the season?
I think it's maturity, Tim. I think I spoke a little bit yesterday and last night about, personally, 2018 for me was a bit of a momentum sort of lucky period towards that end of the season where we just really got on a roll, and I think we struggled with the maturity levels back then to deal with the expectation that came with that. People will sort of have their own opinion about whether we got ahead of ourselves or whatever, but I just think we just didn't deal with the occasion in the years following. But what you're seeing now is a culmination of learning from those experiences and taking, what some would say as negatives as opportunities to continue to grow and get better. And all this group's done is matured into itself and now understands what it takes and really respects the game as far as, how much you've got to put in to get something back that, you're all striving for. And, I felt like we put in a really strong summer, and there's been a lot of work done around, this whole connection piece and an element of, sacrificing to play your role for the team for such functions at a really high level, and you've got complete buy-in and real depth amongst guys that are pushing for selection. I think that's making us a much stronger and more consistent unit.
How many you got coming on? I think it's close enough to a sellout on Saturday night. How many is coming along?
Yeah, I've got a few, mate. I've probably got over 50 at this point. I'm pretty excited about that. You know, it's rare that you obviously get that many tickets, but the chance to acknowledge a lot of people that have had a great impact on my career, you know, past and present, and then obviously getting all of your family and friends along as well. I'm really excited about that, but I'm also conscious of just continuing to tick the box, mate. I'm having so much fun riding the wave at the moment of, you know, winning games and being in a really good place with the team. If you had have asked me back in September last year, would I be in this position? It was it's probably right up in the air, really. And so I'm sort of pinching myself and just enjoying every minute of it.
Nathan, Gary has stated that he'll get a tattoo of you if Melbourne win the premiership. You get to choose where it's placed, and whether it's Nathan Jones late in the career or Nathan Jones early in the career with hair. So which is it?
It'll be late in the career. I'm far better looking now, if you ask my wife. And it'd have to be on the right butt cheek, I reckon.
Done. The Kangaroos whisper. I don't think anyone suggested this was going to be an easy job, and certainly David Noble would have appreciated that as well. But there are some signs, I think, and this is not being facetious. There's some signs that the message is starting to get through. They are super competitive against the Geelong Footy Club down at GMHBA Stadium on the weekend for three quarters. I think pretty sure he'd like to see it go for a little longer. He's been good enough to join us. Dave, welcome.
Thanks, Gary. G'day, Tim.
Hey, Dave.
We spoke pre-season before things got underway. You're five games in now. What are the learnings? And is it different? Is it better? Is it worse than what you've anticipated?
No, I don't think it's worse, Gary. I think there's just lots to learn. You know, the areas that I think we've really started to get our group to understand is the ability to bring regular energy and commitment to AFL standard. You know, that's one of the big things that I think we're driving really hard. You know, the game doesn't really care how old you are as far as the, you know, your average age of your team. So there's a level of expectation that we need to drive as, you know, as a bunch of coaches. And I think our players are starting to really understand and grasp that.
Is that, do you actually see, I know this sounds really simple and basic, but do you actually have to prioritise that above everything else, the effort?
Yeah, I don't think it's too basic at all, Tim. I think that's the, you know, we've all been through those experiences where things, you know, at clubs we've been involved with don't tend to work, and we always cycle back to the basics. So that's where we've really tried to strip it back and just, the energy and the effort that you bring, I think at the moment, far outweighs any tactical element that we might feel, you know, might give us a slight advantage. And because when you bring that effort and energy, it allows you to compete at the basics. And I think if you transfer that to your thinking in finals is all about executing your basics and your fundamentals at a really high, consistent level. And so that's what we're trying to drive.
Is the team behind where you thought they would be at this stage of the year in terms of all those areas of the game that you want them to understand?
Hard to gauge that, I think, Tim. I think if you were able to ask me that this time next year, when I had another pre-season, understood a few of the my players a little bit better in their makeup, I would probably assume that. I don't think that we've shied away from the challenge of what we've wanted to do. We've got a younger group. We've got a totally different style. We've got some changes in the game in general, you know, the man in the mark. And so that, I think that level of excitement of all of those challenges of shifting and changing and driving where we want to go is really, I think, internally creating a lot of positive energy.
You've lived through this. You've been through this at your previous club. So you would have as good an understanding of what sort of the benchmarks are that you need to tick off. Where does a win come into all of this? How important is a win?
Pretty important, guys. There's no doubt that part of your development, and we've been driving that hard with our VFL guys as well, it gives you that nourishment. It gives you the nourishment of a little bit more of, you know, apart from the emotional side, the belief factor, if you like, the connection that your players have post-game, that 5 minutes post when the siren goes, they're able to embrace and understand and really get a feel and a sense that this is what it's about. It's really important. And you know, our fans, and I've made this public, we want to go into every game with a mentality that we want to win. So, you know, we still need to have that as a driving force within our makeup.
So you've got to continue to coach game style and the way you want to play and educate these players in different roles and running, you know, groups through the mid. But you've also got to keep a close eye on spirit and making sure that, you know, that is up. I mean, how's that balance work?
Yeah, we have a really experienced coaching group, you know, guys like John Blakey, you know, being played and been part of successful coaching environments. Heath Uni the same, Gavin Brown the same, Anthony Rocker the same, and a couple of new coaches that we've brought on board. You know, Boomer's part-time with us as well. So we've got a group that I think is able to really keep our players level-headed and calm through all of, you know, the areas that, one, we want to work on. And we have to make sure that our priorities and our reviews are really consistent. You know, they're consistent with what we've set out to do from teaching, education. They're consistent with game plan. They're consistent on the standards that we want to create. And we're not going to waver off those standards. And I think when you do that, you're able to give the guys a sense of clear direction that we need to have.
Talking to David Noble, the coach of North Melbourne, a couple of weeks ago against Adelaide, you led at three-quarter time, fell away badly in the last quarter. When you did the post-game analysis of that particular performance, how much did you concentrate on the negatives of the final quarter as opposed to what got you into that position for three-quarters of that game?
There's probably a balance, Tim. I think it's fair to say that it's probably a 60-40, 70-30, you know, breakdown of the elements that we did well. I think, to be fair, I think with 7 minutes to go, we're only 16 points out of it, behind. So we got a couple of centre bounces poorly wrong, of which we've then taken that away, and we thought we readdressed that this week, and we thought our centre bounce work was a lot better, just in the consistency of it. So, what I think we're starting to slowly see is the evolution of what our game style looks like. Our defence has become, you know, a lot tighter and better in the last couple of weeks. Our offence, you know, we've been probably the number one for going through the corridor, albeit, you know, too often, but we want to be attacking and we want to, you know, create an opportunity to score goals. So those elements have been really pleasing, you know, from each of the learnings each week that we play.
In Torin, and I know coaches don't like to individualise, but in terms of the individuals that are pleasing you, the bright lights, we're talking to a lot of North Melbourne fans out there this morning. What is it that you're excited about now that you're seeing develop?
I think our young guys have got great speed. If you look at our front half of our ground, Powell, Stevenson, Thomas, Marnie, Taylor, Phillips, Lazaro, you know, these guys that are predominantly playing, you know, in the front half. I mean, Joy Simpkin, you know, is another one that you can throw in there. I think once we've got the ball in the front half of our ground, I think our fans can clearly see that we've got some real toe when we get the ball in the right slot. So that's been extremely pleasing as to what we've done. I think the other thing we've tried to do too, Tim, is, you know, last week we had Phillips and Powell play a half on Rory Laird. You know, those opportunities that we're trying to seek to give our guys some experience with some of those roles. I mean, we changed it at halftime, but crikey, those two guys played exceptionally well in the second half for young kids that had taken on a role and then stepped back into the game. Lazaro's, you know, played on a wing. Jack Marnie, we put on Seedsman, you know, in the second half of the Adelaide game. I mean, they're the things that really excite us internally, and hopefully our fans are getting a sense of, you know, what that's starting to look like.
And I want to shout out to Ben Mackay too, who's playing fullback in a team that's, you know, had some goals kicked against them. I've just loved, you know, I've sort of bemoaned a bit the dying art of defending and having to identify space and dangerous space. And I just reckon his last 2 weeks against Taylor Walker and Tommy Hawkins have been really good.
There's no one more proud in our coaching group, Gaz, than John Blakey. As a, you know, as a premiership, you know, defender, who's been working really closely. And look, and the other one I'd like to shout out to, I mean, R2, you know, we traded for him on you know, pre-season through as a small forward, and he's gone back and played as a small defender on the weekend. I think Gavin Brown's done an unbelievable job with him internally to teach him some of that craft. So they're the great little stories internally that we get really excited about.
Nathan Buckley was on 360 last night. Now, there'd been a lot of discussion around whether or not he wants to coach next year. He has the passion for the job, that type of thing. Here's what he had to say last night on 360 about whether or not he desperately wants to coach the Pies next year.
I'm desperately doing that right now and doing it to the best of my ability.
Next year?
Well, I'm contracted at the end of the year, so I don't understand where you're trying to go with this.
I just want to understand your passion. I know your passion's strong, but you shouldn't have to beg for your job and go on TV.
I don't have any desperation in me at all. I'm really focused on what I'm doing right now, and I believe that if I'm doing that job to the best of my capacity and the people around me are thriving and blossoming, well, then that's what a senior coach's role is. If they're not, and if change needs to occur, well, then I'll be a part of having that conversation with the club.
Can we try and read between the lines here?
Yeah, okay. Well, how did you interpret that?
Okay, my interpretation of that is that he was asked a direct question about whether he wanted to coach on again next year, and he didn't answer that directly. He answered that in a roundabout way, and he talked about passion. He's got passion for the leading of the young men. He's got passion for the football club, that type of thing. He was given the opportunity. Now, he can answer the question whichever way he wants. But for me, I was left thinking, well, does he want to coach next year?
Yeah, well, I watched it all. I thought he was in a really reflective and very calm, and Mark Robinson, you know, poked a couple of times, and he got no response. And that was, I think, that was the game plan that Bucks went in. There's a couple of moments where he was a bit Piakaroonish, but that's all right. So then I think what he's saying, and this is the way I read it, and this backs up what he said in that AFL.com interview before the season started, was, I can't tell you about next year because, hey, in 8-10 weeks, it might become patently obvious that my time is up. And if that's the case, then I will, in conjunction with the club, make the really, you know, the right decision for the footy club. So, I don't think he's committed to anywhere other than this week for Collingwood. That's why I read that.
And we have heard coaches in the past when they've been asked similar questions and they're about to come out of contract. Yes, I want to coach. I want to see this 100% job through. Al Clarkson says that all the time.
Yep.
I want to make sure that I see this through. We're building a young team. I want to be part of it. Yep. I want to be the coach. I want to lead them through this. So you do have the opportunity to answer the question in that way.
You do.
If that's what you choose to do.
You do. And I think he's absolutely answered it in twice now. Is to say, I'm in the last year of my contract. I'm passionate. He said, I'm passionate about this week and this job, and I'm going to do everything
I can. And
this
club, yep.
Yeah, so I didn't have an issue with what he said last night. I do think that you can take it one of two ways. You go, that's good. There's a man who's fully invested still, but he realises that he's out of contract at the end of the year and there'll be no renegotiating a contract before then. It'll be on the basis of what happens. Now, on the other hand, there would be some people go, well, hang on, are you with us or not? Are you going to really, you know, you're going to put your stake in the ground and say, no, I want to coach, you know, for the next 5 years. I think he was honest and I quite liked it.
Now, he also, on 360 last night again, obviously he was asked a question about Jordan Dugowie and Howe and the fact that they both had their phones at, not even halftime. It was when they came off the ground after they were both injured. This is how he responded to that.
The bloke we're talking about that grabbed the phones had just been omitted from the game for concussion. So you're not thinking straight. You know, we had a couple of injured players and the bloke that went and grabbed the phones, he wasn't deemed well enough to continue to play a game of footy because of a knock to the head. So that's pretty, I don't think he was thinking straight.
Okay. And if he had been, he wouldn't have picked up the phone.
I wouldn't have thought so.
People would know that.
Correct.
All sorts of discussion about this. You were strong on this yesterday. You believe that the AFL need to come down hard. There are a lot of people that believe the AFL need to come down hard. Collingwood got on the front foot. They explained their position, the fact that it's normally Nick Maxwell who would normally be in charge of the phones and locking them away, that type of thing. So they've tried to give an explanation around this. They're not saying that the players did the right thing. They're saying they did the wrong thing. But I guess they're throwing themselves at the mercy of the AFL and a subsequent penalty. Now, there'll be a penalty of some kind. Mm-hmm. I think it still might be a suspended type penalty, but you still believe along the lines that it'll be stronger and harder and harsher than that.
I think it should be. Whether it is or not, I don't know. And that's exactly what Nathan was doing. He's trying to mitigate the penalty because there's a small plausible deniability in any of that. okay, Jordan Ngoe was concussed, so he was that crazy, didn't realise that he wasn't allowed to get his phone. Well, what about Jeremy Howe? I don't think he had a concussion, did he? He should have. Nathan's saying is that Jordan wasn't thinking straight, therefore he had concussion, therefore we can't blame him. Longest stretch of all time, but okay. Therefore, when he went to Jeremy Howe and handed it to him, Jeremy should have said, Jordan, we ain't allowed to have these, mate. Go and whack. I know you might be concussed, not thinking straight. Go and whack them back in the box. So I get where he's coming from. And I know there's been a cut in the soft cap so that they mightn't have the amount of people. I don't reckon they used to have someone that just sat there looking at the box. Lock the damn box.
No, that's the thing. The person that was supposed to lock the box wasn't there. He wasn't at the game. That's Nick Maxwell, by the way.
He's a box locker.
He's the box locker. Ooh. So where does the – okay, they get penalised, right? Yeah. And there's a fine. What portion of the fine goes to the players and what portion of the fine should go to the club?
Whatever the players get, probably five times goes to the club.
So if they were to be fined $5,000 each, it'd be 25 to the club.
That's the way I would see it. Yep, and for the reasons that I outlined yesterday, there can't be any grey area in any of this. And look, if they go along the lines of what Jared suggested yesterday, okay, we're going to make a statement here, and this is not on. You suspend your sentence, and next time you're going to get the whole damn lot. Then okay, I can live with that.
I mean, I'm a Manchester United fan and have been for 40 years of my life, but I'm disgusted, absolutely disgusted.
Today, I've walked away from my football club. After 40 years supporting them, I can't support this. I can't.
Pretty much the same as most people's reaction, I think. One of alarm, one of concern, and disgust in many ways.
This isn't football. How much money did he want? These clubs, they mean everything to us.
Soulless. It's beyond belief, actually.
Well, Tim, we're on the other side of the world, but even we can get this great sense of how big this story is. There's no bigger story in the UK right now, and that includes COVID, which has brought nations around the world to their knees. But right now, the only thing that is dominating the news cycle is this story about a potential breakaway league. Premier League Supremo Peter Drury has been good enough to join us this morning to fill in some gaps for us, as we've got lots of questions, as I'd imagine all of our listeners have. Good morning to you, Peter.
Good morning to you guys. Good evening from here.
Tell, if you can, give us some sense of just how big a story this has been. We were on air yesterday morning when the news first started to permeate, and then as the day wore on, it got bigger and bigger.
Well, listen, you got it absolutely right. Today, the main evening BBC news was led by this story. Above all of the other international politics and so on. It's absolutely huge here. And indeed across the whole of Europe, because this is our core sport, and there is a danger that it's going to be horribly undermined. It's history, it's heritage, it's base, it's reason for being there, the communities it feeds, the passion it fires in our bellies. It's all threatened by the potential for a league made up of teams who just want to play each other, which will be closed, no danger of demotion, just a complete entitlement, and the effect that it'll have on our competitive football pyramid is potentially horrendous.
Hey, Peter, have FIFA stated that anybody that participates in this competition will be banned from playing domestic and international games? Is that right?
That's what that has been said at the moment. So, in theory, you could have an England team playing. We have the European Championships this summer, as you may or may not know, our summer,
yep,
which were postponed from last year because of COVID. And you could have an England team without any players from Manchester United, Liverpool, Tottenham, Arsenal, Chelsea and Manchester City. Yeah. And that would certainly make for a very interesting England team. Those are, of course, they're only threats at the moment. We're in the first kind of emotional hours after this story really broke. And I think everybody is hoping that the strength of reaction has been so great that there's going to have to be a rethink. Because honestly, I was just saying to your producer, we're in a position here where having this conversation with you isn't in any sense controversial. All I am doing is surfing away. I'm not going out there. I'm not sort of expressing a strong opinion. Absolutely everybody to a man and woman is opposed to this, except it seems for the wealthy owners of the clubs involved.
Mm. So, Peter, who actually announced this, and have they formed some sort of consortium? Is there some group that has already become some little association in their own right?
Yeah, well, essentially, yeah. I mean, there is. I think I haven't been there myself, but I think there is a website for this European Super League. 12 clubs have put their names to it. 6 of those are from the English Premier League, plus the big 2 or 3 in Spain and the big 2 or 3 in Italy. To their great credit, a couple of the giant clubs in Europe have said no for now, notably Bayern Munich, who you all know are one of the great clubs of our continent, and Paris Saint-Germain, who are quite a nouveau riche club, but are nevertheless absolutely mammoth. And those two, to this point, have resisted, though I think the European Super League is still courting them. But yeah, they've essentially got together, and they are currently, so far as we know, because nobody from those clubs has actually spoken. Mm. But so far as we know, they're resisting the sort of clamour to stop doing this. They're resisting all the threats from UEFA and from FIFA, and they're hell bent on doing it. Truthfully, I'd be amazed if it happened, given the strength of reaction today. You know, that there is no sport. You know, you guys understand this. I know how passionate you guys are about sport, and that there is no sport without people to watch it and support it. And honestly, supporters of great clubs like Liverpool and Manchester United have said we just won't watch it. And it's also what will be interesting. And I come at it from this angle, working in television. Mm. I'd be amazed if a television company would want to dirty its fingers with it, you know, and pay the money they would want, because I have a feeling that fans wouldn't have it. They wouldn't subscribe. And without fans, it would just be a mockery.
It would appear that's the immediate reaction. You know, we hear about the Liverpool fans and their reaction, the passion we can feel coming through. So just it's assuming that groundswell, of opposition continues to grow, and then they read the tea leaves and they say, well, we're not going ahead. Where to for these clubs now then?
That is a really interesting question. And you know, you really would have to read the tea leaves to work that out, because who knows how it'll play out. But there has definitely been a breakdown in trust now. Mm. You know, the great northern clubs of our land, especially Liverpool, is probably the most acute example, are all about the relationship between the club and its fans. And actually, there is a very close relationship between the club, or between the players and the fans, between the coach and the fans at Liverpool. But there is going to be, I think, a horrendous mistrust now between those fans and the ownership. Because it's a working class city, you know. Mm. It's a dock city, Liverpool, where people work hard for their money and they pay their money to watch their team. And if they think that the ownership of the team is disconnected from them, they won't have it. Mm. And the same, to a certain degree, is true of Manchester United. Obviously, these are great global clubs, you know, that, which is why you in Australia have some interest in them. But, you know, they're more than local clubs, but essentially they grew out of their locality. And the local people who actually pay their money through the turnstiles, you know, that they need to be taken very, very seriously.
Peter, sorry, just to butt in there, there's been so much money that's been bandied about as to how financially advantageous this will be to those teams that participate. Where is all this money coming from?
Well, I can't answer that. I don't know, except to say that these clubs are owned by some of the very richest people in the world. So money is their thing, and they know how to come by it. I know that's a pretty poor answer and non-specific, but truth be told, the answer is I don't know. What I would say, speaking slightly esoterically, is that wealth, as we all know, is only relative. You know, you're only rich if you're richer than the other people. And I'm amazed at the English clubs, who are in the richest domestic league in the world, which we're very privileged to have in our country, which has built an extraordinary product, which is loved all around the globe. and which therefore gives them relative wealth. You know, they're better off than clubs in other countries because they're part of the Premier League. I'm amazed that they want to go and join in a league where they'll be super, super rich, but only as super, super rich as their immediate opponents. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
It seems odd to me, and it just seems so wrong. What I object to is just the assumption that they can have a non-competitive league. And so the dreams of every football supporter in the land, of the smaller clubs who believe that one day their club might be the one who gets through and gets to compete with Manchester United and Liverpool and Chelsea, you know, that they are just entirely disregarded.